From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. In China, there's upheaval, defiance, and death, and possibly the beginnings of a civil war. How do things in China get to this state? On this edition of Fresh Air, we look for explanations with journalist Orville Schell. He's a longtime China watcher and the author of Discos and Democracy, China in the Throes of Reform. Also today, we meet jazz bass player and composer Buell Neidlinger. He's a versatile performer who leads his own bands, has played with Cecil Taylor, bluegrass musicians, and the Boston Symphony. Actor John O'Keefe is back with another excerpt from his one-man show, Shimmer. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone profiles the comedy collective Funny Gay Males. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. We've recently seen Tiananmen Square in Beijing fill with hundreds and thousands of protesters peacefully demonstrating for a more open society. And we've seen that peaceful expression end in a military massacre. Today we step back from the breaking news coming out of China and put the current upheaval into an historical perspective. My guest Orville Schell has been writing about China since 1967 and has made many visits to that country. His last trip ended just after martial law was declared. Schell has written about China for the New York Times, the Atlantic Monthly, and Rolling Stone. His reports on China for the New Yorker were collected in the book To Get Rich Is Glorious, China in the 80s. His latest book is called Discos and Democracy, China in the Throes of Reform. I spoke with Schell from station KQED in San Francisco. I asked him, when students say they want democracy, what exactly do they mean?
From the student's perspective, it's very simple. They don't understand big systems. They're not even sure whether, you know, how a government should be structured, whether there should be two-party systems, things of that nature. But when they speak of democracy, I think what they really mean is just more freedom of expression. Basic fundamental human rights, freedom to have their own newspaper, freedom for other newspaper and media outlets to be more independent, freedom of travel, freedom of assembly, kind of very fundamental things. Beyond that, they really never got. And then the soldiers came, and of course, even the sort of rather slender questions of freedom of expression just got sort of crushed in the larger issue of power politics.
So would it be unfair to say that the students ideally would like to change from a communist-run government to a government modeled on the United States, which is, I think, the way a lot of people are interpreting the democracy movement in America?
Well, certainly now I think there's a whole new sentiment just to overturn the whole system. I mean, all of a sudden, in a matter of a week, we've gone from what was a reform movement to a revolution in the minds of the students, whereas before they were asking for these sort of modest demands, and not even for the downfall of the Communist Party. Now they are speaking in terms of sweeping the whole thing away. So that just in this instance, there's been this extraordinary chemical change in the sentiment of dissent in China from piecemeal. There was a real sweetness to the students in the square before martial law was declared. I mean, you'd go out and walking among them, and there was a kind of a wonderful, almost a fair-like atmosphere, a sense of elation, confidence, ebullience. No nastiness, very little cynicism. And this is extraordinary for a country which, over the last year or two, had been sinking into a dark sort of pit of despair and sort of cynical skepticism about everything. Suddenly, the students were animated with hope, with optimism, and they, in turn, I think, infected society at large with the sense of maybe there is hope. Maybe we can, by creating this sort of alternate force of power, namely students demonstrating in the streets, we can coax the government into granting a greater modicum of freedom of expression. But we see what's happened, and it's precisely this very violent counter-reaction which I think has changed the chemistry. It turned what was dissent, above-ground dissent, into rage, and what I think very soon will begin to manifest itself as terrorist acts, sabotage, a kind of any way possible to bring this government down, even if it means bringing the economy down with it.
The student movement didn't come out of nowhere. Can you set a context for us?
Well, what's interesting about the student movement is that it's been boiling along in a way which I think we in the West have often not taken adequate notice of. we were very surprised by what happened. And indeed, you know, the sort of superficial attributes of what has recently happened are surprising. But the fact that something happened is not surprising at all. Intellectuals and students have been very dissatisfied for a long time, and they have been growing bolder and bolder and bolder with each passing month. The students demonstrated, you remember, in the very end of 86, and there was a big crackdown in the beginning of 87. Intellectuals this last winter had begun to circulate petitions demanding that the government release political prisoners, that they grant more and more human rights, freedom of expression. There was a groundswell growing, and I think we in the West often missed its importance and significance because we were so infatuated with the idea of economic reform. And it seemed to us, I think, in a way that since China was becoming more and more like us every day, it must be somehow getting better and better and possibly even more stable. And so we missed, I think, the grave consequences of this whole element of society, which was becoming so disaffected and had the ability to articulate this disaffection for society at large, which we now see was the case.
Well, you talk about China becoming more and more like us. Do you think that kind of fanned the frustrations of the students, you know, that once the door was open and once more of Western culture came in, that it built a desire for more freedom of expression?
Yes, I mean, when the hardliners speak about spiritual pollution and bourgeois liberalization from the West, they're absolutely right. It is a highly contagious sort of ideological bacterium, the notion of freedom and democracy. And with, you know, 30-odd thousand students in this country now and elsewhere in the Western world, this contagion has spread rampantly in China. And it's curious, you know, we think of our national interest when George Bush goes on television or Henry Kissinger speaking of our national interest. They rarely take into account that, in a way, our main export, and it's a pity we can't hook the balance of payments up to it, is this kind of vision, this dream of American democracy, of American freedom, out of which culture comes, because out of such a free and open society, we have an enormously seductive culture. And indeed, it is this aspect of America which has seized intellectuals and students in China with incredibly powerful force. And what's sort of tragic about it is having really won so conclusively in a kind of a Cold War sense in China, when the students finally did demonstrate, the American government was really had so little to say to them, so little by way of encouragement. And even now, when thousands have been shot in the streets, our government is so standoffish. I mean, here is the success story of the century. Here is the great payoff of the Cold War, if you will. We have a country that whose younger generation, the intelligentsia, are infatuated with the very notions that we purport to have been fighting for all these decades of the Cold War, and we are so reluctant. It's this curious new alliance between the Chinese Communist Party and the Republican Party, and even a few members of the Democratic Party thrown in, who speak of caution and fear of being too emotional right now. Well, it's an amazing thing to be supporting Contras in Nicaragua and to be, you know, evoking the most favored nation clause in the case of Poland when Solidarity rose up in 82, I believe it was, and, you know, we canceled their favorable tariff considerations, but we do virtually nothing in the case of China.
What do you think the president could have done?
Well, I think early on, this was several months ago, particularly when he was there, and when the dissident astrophysicist Fang Liju was denied entrance by Chinese security to Bush's farewell banquet, he should have made a very strong statement, not interfered in their affairs, not threatened to retaliation, but simply to articulate loudly and clearly that what we stand for as Americans is freedom of expression, travel, assembly, and this is not in the spirit of the American dream, if you will, to deny people access to meetings and to deny them the ability to express their views. Instead, Bush just expressed concern and left, and that was about it. And it was at this point, you see, that I think we should have begun to enter this thing, not as an intruder, but simply to state our views, because these people were turning to us, are turning to us. These are the next generation of the Chinese leadership, not Deng Xiaoping, not Yang Shangkun, Li Peng. These are the people who, if we truly, you know, are looking to the future, we will support, we will help, and we will at least encourage.
My guest is journalist Orville Schell, who's been writing about China since 1967. He recently returned from China. His trip ended just after martial law was declared. By the way, his latest book about China is called Discos and Democracy. Why do you think that it was students that started and led the democracy movement?
Well, students have had a traditionally important role in modern Chinese history in being a kind of a vanguard of new ideas, particularly those ideas which have come in from the outside world. There's been a kind of an innate conservatism in all Chinese governments, the sort of notion of China being central, isolated, self-sufficient, and really fearing and also rejecting various forms of sort of intellectual, political contagion from without. But students, of course, travel abroad, they study abroad, they read, they listen to the radio, and lately, of course, in China, they've seen a lot of American films, television, and whatnot. So that they have, since the fall of the last dynasty in 1911, have always been that element of society which has brought new ideas to China. And, of course, they've also come with this sort of traditional mantle of being, well, they are educated. And this has been a sort of a very hallowed position throughout Chinese history, traditionally speaking. And so they are respected as the bearers of learning. And this combination of learning and politics has been what has made all Chinese pay attention when students act. And, of course, it was 1919 and the May 4th movement when students first took to the streets in China in mass protest against the Versailles Treaty, which turned Japanese German concessions over to Japan. And it is this model of workers in the streets, meeting up with workers, launching mass movements against the government, which is so intimidating to all Chinese governments and very intimidating to this one as well.
Well, haven't intellectuals been kind of mistrusted in the past in China? I mean, in one of your books, you quote Mao as saying, the more educated you are, the more reactionary. And then the Cultural Revolution punished intellectuals as well.
Indeed, it did, yes. And I mean, but one could understand Chairman Mao's ambivalence. I mean, he, on the one hand, was quite a brilliant person, educated in his way, but rather self-educated, and he never had been abroad. He'd never been to university. So at the same time, he was a voracious reader and admired intellectuals and was a good poet and a good calligrapher. On the other hand, I think he had the sense of being an outsider and of being in contempt in some measure, held in contempt by real intellectuals, you know, real scholars, because he was a revolutionary, he was a peasant, he spent his life in the hills. And so this created a kind of a precedent in Chinese communist history of deep ambivalence, almost schizophrenia. On the one hand, wanting intellectuals, recognizing that they were respected, needing their imprimatur on the revolution, but on the other hand, being terribly suspicious of them. And Chairman Mao said intellectuals can go either way. They're very, very untrustworthy. So this is what we see acted out now in the most symbolic form. On the one hand, during the last 10 years of reform, Deng Xiaoping has relied on intellectuals, as he must, as he had to for imagination, for technical know-how, to integrate China into the world again. But on the other hand, there's this deep kind of almost sort of peasant reaction against them, as if they're too independent, too dangerous, too much the spreader of subversion and dissension. And we see that part of the sort of schizophrenic equation being acted out now as soldiers are going house to house, searching the entire capital for people who are on the blacklist and indeed anyone else who they may be suspicious of.
Well, you bring up the soldiers. The military, the first time they went into Tiananmen Square, were turned away from the students. The second time they came in, they crushed the students and killed many of them. I know it's hard to generalize, but who is in the military? Can you give us a sense of what kind of men are in the military now in China? From what parts of the society they're drawn?
Yes. Originally, you know, Terry, back 20 years ago, even 10 years ago, the military, the People's Liberation Army, was one of the most highly esteemed positions. It was enormously competitive. Other than being a party member, being a member of the army was considered to be one of the most exalted sort of stations in life. In the last 10 years, however, with reform, where politics has been replaced by wealth as a measure of one's stature, the military has just, the prestige and status has plummeted. No one wants to be in the military because there's no financial rewards for doing so. And so you get the military now filled up with the poorest of the poor, the least educated people from the countryside, for whom the military is a step up and out of rural poverty. Many cases they speak Mandarin poorly. They're not very sophisticated. They don't understand what's going on in the outside world. And so they are kind of insulated and isolated from all of the sort of cosmopolitan influences which are affecting China's cities in such a profound way. But these people, too, have their grievances. I mean, for instance, most soldiers don't even get a salary, or if they do, a salary of no consequence, maybe $5 a month. They don't even have enough money in some cases for an extra suit of clothes. In fact, when I was last in China a few weeks ago, there was a very celebrated case of one soldier who had committed suicide because he felt there was no future for him. And so the soldiers, on the one hand, will obey orders to some degree. This is their want in any country. On the other hand, they are more and more becoming déclassé. They feel very much that they're being left out of this great experiment in reform. So in the respect that they've now been brought in, one has to understand that they could go either way too, as we've seen, like the intellectuals. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, this crackdown and the ascendancy again of this hardline faction does promise them perhaps a bigger station in China's sort of social mosaic.
Well, we've heard about conflicts within the military. Are there clear factions within the military who are taking different sides, some siding with the pro-democracy movement and others with the hardliners in government?
I think there are, but I think they're very murky, very unclear. And I think, you know, the soldiers of the 38th Army who in effect refused to suppress the democracy movement, it wasn't because so much they believed in democracy. It was, I think, more because they came from location around Peking. They had friends, they knew people. In some cases, the commanders had sons and daughters who were demonstrators. They spoke a common dialect. They had sort of a lot of cultural affinity with the capital. In this case, it really did seem to them, I think, more unthinkable to fire upon the people who they were actually so close to, socially speaking, whereas an army from further out would not have such compunctions. But to say there's political factions, I think it's not so much politics. It's these armies follow their commanders, these old warlords like President Yang Shangkun, who came on the Long March, or Deng Xiaoping. It's a very kind of a personal connection between these people. They've appointed loyal commanders beneath them, and then finally down at the bottom you get these very unsophisticated young peasants who are just take orders. They really don't know much else, and this is what we've seen finally with the 27th Army moving in and machine gunning the students in the square.
Well, let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. My guest is journalist Orville Schell, who's been writing about China since 1967, and he just recently returned from China. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest, journalist Orville Schell, writes about the cultural and political paradoxes of modern China. Schell just returned from China. His trip ended after martial law was declared, and he's written many books about that country. His latest, Discos and Democracy, China in the Throes of Reform, has just been published in paperback. Do you think that there's any chance of the army actually turning against the government?
Well, I think there's a very powerful tendency in China, not only now but earlier, towards feudalization, breaking down into a kind of warring states period. I mean, we've seen this economically over the last year or so as decentralization has allowed more and more power to go out to the provinces and big cities. And I think finally, and the country too, you see, is divided up into these military commands. And as the power at the center of the government becomes more and more diffuse, and they're less able to sort of articulate the muscles of the system, whether it's the party or the army, out in these local regions. And I think it's very likely that as we head into this next winter, where there's going to be monumental food shortages. I mean, this country has been paralyzed. The trains have stopped. You know, there's not oil flowing, coal, the factories have stopped. And I think there's going to be a lot of work stoppages, if not outright strikes. I think we're going to see massive disaffection. We saw it last winter. It was very stark, tremendous sense of cynicism and despair. And I think this government's going to have an awful time this winter, governing. If they had a hard time before this happened, one can imagine with the sort of bankruptcy of their moral credibility as a result of the massacre in Tiananmen Square, plus the economy, which was just, was very delicately balanced even before. Now, I think we'll be in a state of advanced collapse. So I think that we will see power further devolving to the regions. We will see armies becoming more and more centers unto themselves, just as we've seen the economy become more and more centered on regions rather than on Peking.
Well, Deng Xiaoping has been in power since 1977. And I think he was originally seen as a liberalizing force and a force for economic reform. Has he changed a lot? I mean, what happened that now he's the hardliner?
Well, remember, he came to power by extolling the students at Democracy Wall in 1978 and 79, only to crack down ruthlessly afterwards. And some of those students are still in jail, like Wei Jingsheng, very extremely bright and articulate spokesman for what he called at that point China's fifth modernization, democracy. I mean, Deng Xiaoping had said they needed four, agriculture, industry, science, national defense. So, I mean, this was his entrance onto the stage, and I think he bespeaks of a kind of deep schizophrenia that is manifested in society and the body politic as a whole, namely a fascination with reform, a recognition that China needs it to survive, but a kind of an aversion to certain inevitable consequences of reform, namely more democratization, more freedom, more opening up. So on the one hand, they want a capitalist economy, which does apply a kind of a freewheeling, more open society. On the other hand, they keep trying to stamp out these what they call bad influences, bourgeois liberalization, on the other hand. And it represents a massive contradiction and I think an incomplete comprehension of the total notion of reform, that reform means values, politics, culture, as well as the economy. And you can't, it's like being a little bit pregnant. You just can't be a little bit pregnant. You can't reform a little bit and open up a little bit, keep out certain things and let other things in. It all comes rushing in. And I think Deng Xiaoping is not sophisticated enough, not cosmopolitan enough to understand the complexities of the way a society changes when the doors are thrown open.
It's in the two largest communist societies now, there's big change happening. In the Soviet Union, it's being organized from the top down through perestroika, Gorbachev's reforms. And in China, we're seeing it happen from the bottom up through the pro-democracy movement, which is being squelched right now. Is it coincidence, do you think, or something larger than that that's responsible for this impulse of change in both of those communist countries at the same time?
Well, I think, curiously enough, both countries, there's a similarity. These reforms tend to start at the top. Leaders say, oh, we better reform, we need to become more wealthy, more prosperous, more powerful. But then, unwittingly, at least from their point of view, the bottom begins to become, inspired, begins to wake up, and then they begin to grab the reforms that this top has sort of approved, and they begin to run with it themselves. And this is the way China began. I mean, Deng Xiaoping began reforming from the top. And slowly, the students, the intellectuals, and now I think even the workers are beginning to wake up, and they say, we want more of this. We don't want to be told what we can have. I mean, Fang Lijie, the great astrophysicist and Chinese dissident, said, democracy isn't something that you wait to be handed from the top. It is yours by birth, and you take it. And this is what's happened in China. And I think we're seeing a similar process in the Soviet Union now, although the economic reforms are much less advanced. We're seeing people in you know, the various Soviet republics rising up, and they want even independence. And in you know, Moscow, they are demanding their freedom. They're not waiting for it to be parceled out by the Communist Party.
The suppression that we're seeing now in China, does that bring to mind the same kinds of tactics that we've seen during previous crackdowns in that country?
Yes, and again, I think it reflects this kind of deep ambivalence towards reform, the schizophrenic nature of these old-time Chinese reformers. On the one hand, they want to loosen up, and on the other hand, when things begin to get a little out of control from their perspective, or people begin to talk back to them to speak up, their reflex reaction is clamped down. And you begin to get all this old rhetoric about counter-revolutionaries and bad elements. And you know, I believe that we're going to see some very serious repression. People will be arrested, and I think they may try to take Peking and make it a model of what happens when people dare stand up, take to the streets, humiliate the leaders, and ask for freedom. They may take some intellectuals out and execute them. Counter-revolutionary is a very, very bad word in China to these old guys. They do not use it unless they are deadly serious that these people are, you know, really enemies. And once labeled an enemy, the history of intellectuals in China has been very, very bleak indeed. And that's why I think at this particular point it's so necessary for other countries such as our own to speak up, to speak out, and to put the Chinese leaders on notice that we are not simply going to construe our relationship with China to be a relationship with them and the leaders, but in fact with the people of China, with the next generation of China's leadership who have dared to stand up now and who will have the most have taken a tremendous risk in doing so.
We only have about a minute left, but I'm wondering, can the government function without the popular support of the people and with only partial support of the military?
Well, I think not, but I could be surprised. I mean, we look at Poland again. The only way the Communist Party survived there against Solidarity and using this as a model was because the Soviet Union was in the wings threatening to march in. China has no army outside which will come in and support the government, and the government is so totally alienated itself now from the people. It is inconceivable to me that it will be able to govern effectively, if at all, in the coming months and years.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about China. We just have a few seconds left. Are there any words you want to add before we conclude?
Well, this period has been just a devastating tragedy for China, and I think in a way, we are custodians in this country of the future, of the hope of that country, perforce of the 30,000 students who are now here, many of whom can't go back, many of whom have parents, wives, children in China. And I hope that our government will do everything it can. I hope Bush will find the courage to speak out, not to preserve too religiously what he calls this important relationship with this government, which indeed will not be around long, and if it is around long, should not be around long. And I hope this is made very clear at the highest levels in Washington as soon as possible.
Orville Schell, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. My guest has been Orville Schell, and he writes about the culture and politics of modern China. He returned from China very recently after martial law was declared. His latest book about China, Discos and Democracy, China in the Throes of Reform, has just been published in paperback by Anchor Doubleday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, we'll talk about the rights of whores. My guest will be Gail Peterson and Margot St. James. Their new book, A Vindication of the Rights of Whores, examines prostitution practices around the world. It also looks at how American feminists have responded to women who work in the sex trades. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Buell Neidlinger has been called a musical polymath, an accurate description for a musician who's played with Cecil Taylor, Roy Orbison, Coleman Hawkins, Frank Zappa, and the Budapest String Quartet. Coming up, we meet Buell Neidlinger and listen to new and reissued recordings. Also, performance artist John O'Keefe returns with another excerpt of Shimmer, his humorous recollections of life in an Iowa youth detention center. And critic at large Laurie Stone has a review of Funny Gay Males, three comedians who are just what they advertise. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
Now this news.
I'm Sharon Green. Deng Xiaoping appeared on state-run television in China today. It was his first appearance since the bloody repression of pro-democracy demonstrations over the weekend. The 84-year-old senior leader praised army units which rolled over protesters in Tiananmen Square. Deng and other Chinese leaders were seen paying their respects to the soldiers killed in the attack. There was no mention in today's broadcast of the hundreds, perhaps thousands, of unarmed civilians who were slaughtered. James Miles has details from Beijing.
In an address translated here into English, Mr. Deng extended his regards to the security forces involved in imposing martial law in Peking.
This hurricane came not determined by the will of the people. This is a counter-revolutionary uprising. Their purpose is to overthrow the Communist Party and destroy socialism and turn the Chinese Republic into a bourgeois republic. During this suppression of the uprising, the PLA troops demonstrated high political consciousness and bravely risked their lives to put down the uprising.
Mr. Deng said a small number of people had created turmoil in China and that this had led to what he called a counter-revolutionary rebellion. The joint appearance of the 10 men suggested that a degree of consensus has emerged in the recent struggle for power.
The BBC's James Miles. Even though students and workers have been suppressed in Beijing, there are still large-scale demonstrations outside the capital. In Shanghai, some 40,000 people demonstrated in the city today, calling for democratic reforms and protesting the Beijing killings. The Bush administration today condemned the Chinese leadership for what it called the murder of many of its citizens. Spokesman Marlon Fitzwater also denounced calls for reprisals against the leaders of the pro-democracy movement. The State Department said today that slightly more than 1,500 Americans remain in China, down from 8,800 a week ago. An armed mob of 5,000 people rioted in the Soviet Republic of Uzbekistan today. Officials said 100 people suffered gunshot wounds in the republic's sixth day of ethnic violence. At least 80 people have died since the unrest began last weekend, NPR's Ann Cooper reports.
Soviet television tonight showed burning houses and crowds running through the streets in the Uzbek town of Kokand. The TV report described the attackers only as thugs and said they were armed with automatic rifles, pistols, and knives. Today's attacks were aimed at police and at Meskhetians, an ethnic minority in the republic. The TV report said the rioters had specific political goals, but gave no further explanation. Officials told Soviet TV that more troops were sent to the region today as they struggled to contain the worst reported ethnic violence in recent Soviet history. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
The inaugural session of the Soviet Union's new Congress closed today, with President Mikhail Gorbachev denying that he's hungry for power. At the same session, human rights activist Andrei Sakharov called the 13-day session a failure. He said the Congress was not able to establish a system of power that would help overcome economic and social problems, as well as end what Sakharov called ecological madness. The new parliament session was broadcast live on Soviet TV. The session contained unprecedented public criticism of the Kremlin leadership. Wholesale inflation shot up in May by nearly a full percentage point. The 0.9% increase reported today by the Labor Department contributes to an annual inflation rate of 9.4%. That's more than double the 4% increase last year and quadruple the inflation rate in 1987. Stock prices were slightly lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 3 points to close at 2513.42. Advances led declines on volume of 175 million shares. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. San Francisco-based actor and writer John O'Keefe joins us again in our weekly performance spot. He's going to take us back into the world he created in his piece Shimmer, a world drawn from his own childhood experiences and fantasies, growing up in a broken home and intermittently living in detention centers as a ward of the state.
This story is true. Well, most of it. It was the end of a long, bad time. The fall of 1956 in the heartland of America. Tama County Juvenile Home in Tama, Toledo, Iowa, just off Highway 30. Had this tall red brick chimney that stuck up out of it like a marker. I can remember others. 7, 8, 9 tall red brick chimneys sticking up out of the flat Midwestern landscape. Nebraska, Iowa, Illinois. God and razor straps. 5 long razor straps in Tama County Juvenile Home. Lined up and hanging on the wall with holes in the top so that they'd whistle and make tattoos, hanging right where you could see them. Tama, Toledo. The worst and the best. Best because it was the last. Worst because the razor straps were harder to take the older you got. Best because I met Gary Welch. Gary and me pulled cafeteria. We had to be there at 5 a.m., an hour before the rest of the kids got up. Most of the kids hated kitchen duty, but Gary and me, we liked it because we could walk under the Iowa sky, ablaze with its Easter egg light, the air filled with the sound of roosters and dogs and birds and our leather shoes as we walked from Hoover Hall to the cafeteria. People don't think that dogs can think. I think they do. So do I. I think that birds can think. Me too. I think that bugs can think. I do too, Gary. Fact, I think that worms can think. Me too. Fact, I think that dirt thinks. I don't know, man. It'd be pretty hard in the dirt. I mean, all those people walking around it, digging into it and everything. Anyway, what parts of the dirt? The little parts of the whole ground? Well, the little parts think like the little parts, and the whole ground thinks like the little parts when the little parts think of themselves as being the field. Well, where's the field end? Where the fences are. Well, why there? Because the fences tell the ground when it's a field. The cafeteria was one of the most exciting places of all. It's because that's where everybody came together, i.e., the boys and the girls. Everybody waited outside the cafeteria, the bell would ring, and then everybody would file in according to cottage. One of the patrons would begin the morning prayer. Bless us, O Lord, for these thy gifts which we are about to receive from the grace of thy bounty through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. The rustle of chairs and the clinking and the clanking of silverware and plates, and then silence. There was absolutely no talking allowed in the cafeteria. The sections were patrolled by the patrons and the matrons who paced the aisles between the tables to ensure the security of silence. Evie, big, fat-faced, black-haired grinner, would roll between the boys' tables, his arms folded over his pot belly, just waiting to give one of his infamous ear claps, which meant that he would attempt to clap his hands together with your head in between them. He could come up on you so quiet, you didn't know he was there. And no matter how much winking and finger twitching the guy on the other side gave you, he would inevitably catch you whispering to a buddy or gazing at a girl across the room, and then pop! A mind-blackening explosion would send your ears wailing for the rest of the day. And old Evie, he wouldn't say nothing. He'd just roll on down the aisle, that same grin on his face. Going together in the home meant sneaking glances at each other across the cafeteria. Is someone looking at you, Beatrice? Matron says this. Who's looking at you? Come on, girl, stand up and show us who's looking at you. Beatrice stands up, but she doesn't look at him. She doesn't want to get him in trouble. The matron slaps her. Who's looking at you? She doesn't look. She slaps her again. I said, girl, who's looking at you? She slaps her again, and she still doesn't look at him. She's just about to slap her when, bam, Davy stands up, and he looks at Beatrice. Evie strides over to him and says, what you looking at, boy? Sit down. But Davy doesn't sit, so Evie, wham, shoves him down in his chair. Davy gets up, and Evie slaps him. Davy doesn't sit down, so Evie whacks him in the back of the head. Davy's chin smacks against his chest. He lifts his head up, and he looks across the cafeteria at Beatrice. The fat cow matron has stopped slapping her. Everybody in the room, in fact, is looking at him except for Beatrice. Davy smiles. Blood's coming from the corner of his mouth. Davy's bit his tongue pretty bad. Evie grabs Davy by the collar and he pushes him out of the cafeteria. The fat cow matron tells Beatrice to sit down and keep her eyes to herself. She does. That's love. Love in the home.
John O'Keefe will perform Shimmer during July and August at Second Stage in New York City. This is Fresh Air. Bassist and composer Buell Neidlinger has had a long and varied career, beginning as a child prodigy playing the cello with the New York Philharmonic. In the 1950s, he was Cecil Taylor's first regular bassist. Their early recording sessions together have just been released by Mosaic. He's had a classical career, performing with the Boston and Houston Symphonies and the Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra. He's also taught bass, chamber music, and music history. In recent years, Neidlinger has made his living doing studio work, while leading three music groups. His group Thelonious performs only tunes by Monk. Aurora is a group he formed with drummer Peter Erskine and tenor saxophonist Marty Crystal. Their new album includes mostly original compositions. And his group String Jazz plays the compositions of Monk and Duke Ellington. Their latest release, Locomotive, includes this Mercer Ellington tune, Jumpin' Pumpkins.
I always like the sound of the violin and the mandolin together, and when you put them with a saxophone, then you get a unique American sound that's been going around since, I think, about 1915, when they used to have bands like that before, you know, in the South.
The repertoire that the String Jazz group plays is mostly Monk and Ellington, and I wonder, what do you learn by going very deeply into the work of composers?
Well, The only music I play anymore mostly is, unless I wrote it myself or one of my friends did, is Monk and Ellington, because to me they're the chief American composers. I write with Copland, Ruggles, and Ives, and possibly even more important than those composers, and so that's why I play them. And what do I learn from it? I don't know. I just like the music very much.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that your classical training has helped you a lot as a jazz musician?
No, the whole thing is one ball, you know. And whatever I studied and learned, and when I pick up the instrument, that's what I put to work. So it runs the whole gamut of my experience, from playing with Willie the Lion Smith to Sir John Barbaroli, you know. Covers the whole spectrum.
In jazz, you became well-known for playing with Cecil Taylor, joining him in the mid-50s. How did you meet up and start playing together?
Well, he needed a bass player, and nobody else was interested in playing with him, I guess, and so that's how he got me. And actually, I was, a member of the original Cecil Taylor unit, if I'm not mistaken, and I made all of his first recordings, which are now being reissued on the Mosaic label.
When you started playing with Cecil Taylor, what was he doing different from any other pianist that you'd ever played with?
Everything. Everything was different. He's a completely unique fellow. And he still is, from what I can gather. So he's maintained that.
But what struck you most, though, when you...
Well, it's a fantastic energy in his playing struck me most. And also the quite the developed musicality that he possessed. It's another complete ball there. Fantastic.
In some of these sessions from the 1950s that have just been reissued, Cecil Taylor is playing really outside, and you're playing really tight rhythms behind
really?
Him. Very, very propulsive.
Find is playing that outside, but anyway, it depends on what your hearing experience has been, how outside things are, you know. By the time I'd played with Cecil Taylor, I'd already heard Stravinsky, Bartok, Schoenberg, Webern, and Berg, so and Ruggles and Ives and people like that, so to me it wasn't that outside.
In your liner notes you write that Cecil Taylor sometimes liked to create anger at sessions. Did you think of him as having a musical reason for doing that?
Not just at sessions. He enjoyed watching that energy in many situations, and I guess he still does today. He has a little perversion that way. But I suppose he felt that he could obtain some out of the ordinary musical energy from players who were angry. Yeah.
What would he do to make you angry to get that energy?
Oh, maybe do about 30 too many takes of the tune after it was all gone, or like in the case of one tune on this reissue here, Air, I think it's 29 takes or something like that. You know, and in fact, take 9 is the masterwork. So, you know, it's just, it's a tradition, I think, in that sort of music to egg people on in various ways, you know.
Once more.
You eventually moved to Los Angeles. Was that because of all the session work there?
At the time I moved to Los Angeles, I was a member of the Boston Symphony Orchestra. And I moved here to teach at a place which I don't even mention anymore. And I taught there for 11 years and did a lot of sessions. And now I just do a lot of sessions.
Mm-hmm.
But I still play music. I play... some people call it jazz. I just call it music, and I do that as often as possible.
You've done a lot of sessions, and I'm sure some of them have been great fun and musically fulfilling, and that of others, and that others have been music that you'd perhaps consider kind of schlocky, and it's been a chore, but it paid okay. Can you give an example of a session that you'll always remember?
One, certainly several wonderful sessions come to mind. One session that comes to mind the most recently is one with Roy Orbison, where he recorded his last album. That was a thrilling session to actually, in this day and age of technology, work with someone who could sing the whole song on one take and make it what he did. That was a thrill. Another session that comes to mind that was certainly interesting was one time I got a call about 9:30 at night, and it would come down to Studio 55. I got there. It was Barbara Streisand sitting at the piano, and she was playing this, not too well, this thing she had written, and she said, let's put a bass on this. So I stood behind at the piano, and we put a bass on it, and of course later she said it was too cabaret, so I had to do it over again, but you know, that turned out to be Evergreen, which was, I guess, one of her biggest hits. And that sort of thing is always fun, you know.
I want to play something from your new record, Aurora. And this features you on bass and Marty Crystal on tenor saxophone and Peter Erskine on drums. I want to play a piece that you wrote for this record. It's called Buell Street Blues. Do you want to say anything about it?
Sure. Buell Street Blues is a play on Beale Street Blues, and it's actually a sort of a paraphrase of that piece. It was one of my favorite compositions of W.C. Handy.
Can I just get you to hum a few bars of Beale Street Blues for our listeners?
Sure. If Beale Street could talk, if Beale Street could walk, like that. But the similarity is in the modulation. Because after it goes again, ba doo ba doo ba, ba doo ba doo ba, dee ba doo ba doo ba doo ba doo ba doo ba, and here comes the mod, like a trombone, boy, ba ba doo ba, goes to the other key, a fourth up. And that's what Buell Street Blues does too, except it's in the minor.
Neidlinger performing with Aurora on their new album, Aurora, on Denon Records. We also heard music from his string jazz record, Locomotive, on Soul Note, and from the complete candid recordings of Cecil Taylor and Buell Neidlinger on Mosaic. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is joining us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, from China, we saw pictures of Deng Xiaoping today.
That's right. Deng Xiaoping, together with a number of other officials, posed for pictures and appeared on television. We think that means that we now know who's in charge in China, and or at least it's becoming clearer. We'll have more on that. The Congress of People's Deputies concludes in the Soviet Union. And then on a lighter side, we're going to have a little list of summer reading. We're going to take a look at who's likely to win the Belmont Stakes, and Penn Jillette of Penn & Teller, he does magic, among many other things, will be with us too.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Stand-up comics often make jokes about gay people. Critic at large Laurie Stone has a review of a group of gay comics who want to make the jokes instead of being the butt of them.
It's not surprising that most of the gay men in stand-up are in the closet, because gay bashing is standard material, and MCs have been known to wipe off the mics of men they know are gay. Funny Gay Males is the only collective enterprise of its kind, a trio that includes Danny McWilliams, Bob Smith, and Jaffe Cohn. They work in markedly different styles, but they're part of a fresh crew of gay entertainers who get laughs without attacking women or minorities. They talk about gay life from the inside, offering alternative images of maleness, bringing in AIDS and the gallows humor of curtailed sex. Danny McWilliams has tender eyes, but his elastic clown's mouth can't stop camping.
I do. I live in the Upper West Side of Manhattan. It's so bizarre up there. It is so bizarre around all of Manhattan, because you know what I find lately that's weird? These Haitian and Jamaican women who take care of these young little white kids while the mother and father go off to work. Have you ever seen that? Oh, they're all over. See, that is so weird to me, because I always think that those kids think that's their mother and all they're going to take after them, you know? It's true, because the other day I walk out in the street, you know, I see Kellyanne O'Donnell out in the street, this three-year-old little white kid. I was like, oh, I said, Kellyanne, how are you? She said, child, don't ask. Next week I start kindergarten class. Woo!
Bob Smith is tall and buttoned down with a deadpan delivery calculated to raise anxiety. You wonder, does this guy know he's on stage and not in a Sears ad? In his persona, polite unemotionalism spars with bluntness.
It's not easy telling your parents that you're gay. I made my carefully worded announcement at Thanksgiving. I said, Mom, would you please pass the gravy to a homosexual?
Jaffe Cohn, a little guy with glasses and one turquoise earring, wanders a landscape mined with complaints.
But now that I'm so out in the open, straight people come up to me all the time and they say, Jaffe, why did you choose to be gay? Why did I choose to be gay? Like, I'm 12 years old, I'm given a menu. Homosexuality. I see that comes with a large helping of alienation and abuse. Oh, what the hell, we'll give it a try. Thank you very much.
Recently, I had drinks with funny gay males. Off stage, a lot of comics do compulsive shtick as if the world were a giant couch across from which sat Johnny or Dave. Some comics aren't witty when not holding a mic, but these guys, without apparent effort, are open and silly. Cohn has been doing comedy for only 3 years. He was writing plays before. He said he'd been reworking one about a man who was trying to break away from his mother, but he couldn't figure out the ending because he never broke away from his. Smith started working in clubs when he was 18, then quit for a while. The AIDS epidemic inspired him to return because it made him feel he ought to do what he really wanted with his life. The men think there's still a lot they don't do. In their acts, they define themselves as gay sons and families, essentially the children of parents. Putting sex in routines is the next thing, they say, and they see that as another level of coming out. An influential talent manager recently told Smith he could advance his career greatly by dropping the gay material. He wasn't tempted. The others hold the same view. They have day jobs and comedy earns them an average of $3,000 a year, but they think it's only a matter of time before out gay men get to mount pieces like the Kathy and Mo show, a successful off-Broadway feminist comedy evening. Smith thinks there will come a time when they'll be sitting across from Johnny, and even Dave.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic, and is a contributor to The Village Voice. Funny Gay Males perform on Friday nights at the Duplex in New York. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, we talk with composer Danny Elfman, who wrote the music for the movies Beetlejuice, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, Big Top Pee-wee, and the forthcoming Batman. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews some new albums on musician Vinnie Golia's Nine Winds label. And television critic David Bianculli has a preview of Firstborn. It's a new cable miniseries from the same people who made The Lives and Loves of a She-Devil. And David says this series is just as good and as weird as that one was, so I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet. Production assistants from Lisa Bruton and Steve Plever. Research assistants from Linda Martin and Christopher Cook. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.